The films of Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, and Steven Spielberg have in many ways defined American pop culture for the last 50 years. The careers of the three men were significantly intertwined from the beginning, although those careers diverged in rather dramatic ways. Author Paul Fisher tells the story of how these three men changed Hollywood forever in his new book, The Last Kings of Hollywood. We're lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Roger. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
So, Paul, let's talk about how you got here. What motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
It took a long time. I went to film school 15 years ago, probably a bit more now. And I wanted to be a filmmaker. And I remember back then people would read Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, and it was this kind of myth about the 70s. And it was the kind of age of, you know, drugs and rock and roll in excess. And there's this narrative of film in that time of like filmmakers made great films, but they were kind of crazy. They took over the asylum, and then the grown-ups had to come back in. And that never felt quite right to me. And, you know, there's kind of this narrative that the decade starts with these film school kids coming in, and then films like Heaven's Gate and Apocalypse Now and New York, New York, films where these filmmakers spent a lot of money, nearly sank their studios, and had to be reined in. And I thought there was actually a more interesting story in framing it, this time period in... Well, actually, the first film school graduate to ever make a studio film is Francis Coppola. And the first thing he does with the money from that studio film is with this other kid called George Lucas. They go up to San Francisco and they start basically a startup, like a modern Silicon Valley startup. They get a warehouse, they get new technology. They go, we're going to disrupt the system, make films a different way, and we don't need the studio system. And through various ways, the period actually ends when one of them, through Star Wars and Lucasfilm and all this stuff, basically invents the modern studio system. And I thought that narrative and that framing around these guys actually having agency and intelligence and planning and vision on a systemic kind of scale was more interesting to tell.
So let's go back to the beginning. You make that wonderful observation at the beginning of the book that, which may or may not be true, that Lucas walked onto Warner Brothers the day that Jack Warner walked out. Where were the studios in the late 60s? The old system, what was going on with it?
Well, they were kind of dead. You know, 1967, which is when George Lucas arrives at Warner Brothers, you know, this was a time period when Warner Brothers had been bought out by a Canadian company called Seven Arts. A lot of these studios were getting bought out over at Paramount. I think they were paving over the archives to make a parking lot, you know. So the studios were kind of in a very, very dark patch. They had done very well until the late 40s. And then television came in and a younger audience came in and European film came in. And the guys who had run the studios, like Jack Warner, were still there. Yeah. And they were in their 70s and 80s and couldn't quite keep up. And so when Lucas tells the story of coming out of film school and coming into Warner Brothers for this internship scholarship where he meets Coppola on the same day Jack Warner leaves. It might literally be true. It's roughly true.
We're keeping
close enough in the sense that that kind of summer, Jack Warner left. Jack Warner had sold the studio. He stayed long enough to be kind of an honorary kind of chairman guy. And then he left and went along. But the studios at the time, you know, they'd have people under 7-year contracts, and that was done and gone. They used to own their cinemas, and the Supreme Court had said, you can't do that anymore. That's a monopoly. And so people weren't going to the movies, and the old guys in charge had no idea how to fix it.
So Coppola comes in. What's his first significant film? I mean, his student film was significant. Tell us about that, and how did it lead to his first significant film?
Well, he was Coppola is a New York guy, Queens guy, theater, went to study theater at Hofstra, thought of himself as one of those kind of theater directors, novelists, like really an artist, almost in a European kind of way. And so he goes to UCLA to study film. And while he's at UCLA, he's kind of fed up with the whole way film school goes there at the time, which is really kind of a bunch of kids coming over, smoking pot, messing around, talking about being arty, not really getting very much done. And as we all know of Francis Coppola now, he's the kind of guy who likes to get stuff done even when it's a bad idea. And so while he's still at film school, he kind of branches off on these two separate things where he starts, you know, editing kind of disreputable films for money, and he starts working for Roger Corman, who's a B-movie producer guy. And he makes this horror film, slasher horror film, that's kind of grisly and weird for Roger Corman, and that's his first film. And he rewrites screenplays and gets a reputation for writing well and quickly, and so he becomes a staff writer at Warner Brothers 7 Arts and makes a lot of money. You know, he's in his late 20s and he's got a couple of kids and a gold watch and a Porsche and a big house, and everybody at UCLA is calling him a sellout. And then he takes some of that money and he kind of invests it into two things, which are both very Coppola-y. One of them is, I can't remember what these things were called, but they were kind of video jukeboxes for like diners and stuff. And so he loses all that money because that's a stupid idea, at least back then. And he puts the other investment into a film for himself to direct that he thinks this is going to be a bit personal. It's going to be creative. It's going to be kind of like a Richard Lester, Hard Day's Night kind of madcap thing. And it'll make my reputation. And he makes this film independently. He brings it back to UCLA while everybody's, you know, filing 11-minute black and white short films as their thesis films. He goes, here's my feature film that's playing at the Cannes Film Festival next month. I'll take my degree now. And so he becomes kind of a legend, you know, to these film school kids who are like, oh, everybody tells us this is fake school. There's no jobs out of this. And this guy's just making it happen. And so from that film, Warner Brothers goes, all right, we'll give you Finian's Rainbow. We'll give you this kind of stodgy Broadway adaptation with 200-year-old Fred Astaire starring in it. And you can direct that for the studio. And that's where he meets Lucas.
So Lucas comes onto the set, and I'm not sure that's what he was expecting to find. As you say, a stodgy Broadway production.
No, and like, you know, we have this image of George Lucas now where you think, okay, you know, little guy in the shirts and the jeans and a lot of money and the beard, and he's a bit quiet and he's got a sort of hamstery vibe. But George Lucas in 67 at film school, you know, he's cool. He's got a bit of mod style. He likes fast cars. He hates narrative. He hates the man. He hates the system. All he wants to make is like underground. He calls them abstract visual mood poems. you know, he hates writing. He thinks anything with stories is stupid. Anything for an audience to just go from A to B is stupid. But he's a very talented young filmmaker. And so he gets this internship to go to Warner Brothers. And his first thought is, I'd like to go to the animation department. You know, at least then I can get a camera. I can get some stuff. You know, animators make films. They don't just work somewhere on the crew. They make films. And so he gets there and the animation department is dead, empty. And really the guy at Warner Brothers says, look, the studio's dead. There's only one film happening. It's this musical about a leprechaun. You know, Fred Astaire is in it. That's the only one you can shadow. And he's a bit grumpy about it until he sees, oh, this Francis Coppola guy who went to UCLA across town, who's a legend, he's directing this thing. And so he figures it'd be interesting to go check that out. He goes to check it out. And really, the kind of short, long and short of it is they're both the only two young guys on the set. They're the only two non-union guys. They're the only guys with beards and not kind of clean shaven. And they bond over this idea of this system that used to be glamorous is completely broken and it moves so slowly and it makes all the wrong decisions for all the wrong reasons. But if we could do a version basically of what Coppola had done with that first film, which is take the money out of the system, go somewhere and do our own thing. We understand that we have smaller cameras. We understand that there's new editing machines. We understand that kids don't want to see ripoffs of The Sound of Music every 3 months, then we could take the whole thing over. And they kind of hatched this plan to do that immediately.
And they go on a road trip.
So they're kind of, their proof of project, as it were, is Coppola goes, look, I've written this script. It's called Rain People. I don't really know how it goes, where it ends, but it's about this woman. She's married. She has a crisis of kind of like identity. She leaves her family and she goes on a road trip, and how about to test this equipment and this stuff? We're going to put the editing machines in a van. We're going to put the cameras in the back of the van. We're going to take a crew of a few people and we're going to film this driving around the country, making it up as we go. And if we manage to make a film that way without executives breathing over our necks and doing stuff on the go, then we've kind of proven that we can do some other version of that forever. And so they make this film, and they drive around, and Lucas makes a behind the scenes kind of film of it as it goes. And you know, Coppola tells him writing is power. If you don't write, you're kind of dependent on what scripts you're offered. So he writes this adaptation of student short film called THX 1138 while he's going, and the film The Rain People has James Caan in it and Robert Duvall, who are both kind of young guys from out east as well, and these guys all bond and they talk about wanting to do stuff differently. You know, Caan and Duvall are like, especially Duvall, not your standard kind of John Wayne looking leading man. And so all this energy, it kind of builds up as they go, and then near the end of the shoot they hear of this guy out in Marin County, kind of across the bridge from San Francisco, called John Cordy, who's already got an Oscar for a documentary, and he does everything in his barn. And, you know, he hates violent films, and he hates sexy films, and he hates corporate films, and he's making a living doing stuff just out of a barn. And Coppola and Lucas go, all right, we're going to go see this John Cordy guy. We're going to talk about how he does it, and maybe we'll do this in the Bay Area, which Lucas, that was his kind of home turf, and he was happy to do that.
Yeah.
I want to skip a little bit, because we have a repeating vision where Coppola wants to create his own sort of almost commune studio, for lack of a better concept. And obviously The Godfather comes along and he makes huge amounts of money. He has this ambition to create this, you know, functioning studio project in San Francisco. Can you sort of talk about that vision and why it didn't work?
Well, there's kind of a push and pull to it, right? The first version of this is, after me and Cordy, they get a warehouse on Folsom Street in San Francisco. And the idea is, we've got 300 grand from Warner Brothers. We're going to have a kind of commune, bunch of young guys making films. They're all going to be individual films. We're all going to be equals. But it kind of pans out really quickly that, on the one hand, Coppola is the kind of guy who says we're all going to be equal, but he kind of wants to be a bit more equal than everybody else. You know, he says we're going to be kind of a socialist, commune, hippie vibe, but he also wants to drive his Porsche and be the guy who has like the green light decision-making power. And, you know, he wants everybody to feel free, but he also wants to be the guy who says, hey, you're only here because of my success. And on the other hand, you've got people like Lucas and Cordy who are saying, hey, we love the underground, we love San Francisco, we love all of this, but they're also kind of like straight-laced nerds. You know, and the first time Lucas steps foot in this warehouse and people are playing pool and there's girls in miniskirts in the front and there's an expensive espresso machine and there's weird smelling smoke everywhere, he's like, nah, I work from home. I'm not coming back here. And so the whole thing kind of falls apart immediately. And Lucas makes THX 1138, this film that's kind of dystopian and dark and depressing. And Warner Brothers see it and they go, Francis, you promised us like cool films for young people, which to them meant like, you know, Beach Bunny movies and surfer pictures and rock and roll music. And so they pulled the funding. And the reason, the only reason Coppola does The Godfather, which he thought was beneath him, was they needed money, you know, so the bailiffs and the sheriffs wouldn't come and like put locks on the door. And then because of the success of The Godfather and because of the later successes that Lucas has, their visions kind of split in two different ways, right? Like Coppola, the evolving version of American Zoetrope is he kind of wants to do something that's a hybrid between the old studio system, but where he's Jack Warner, and the theater troops and kind of system that he loved at university, where you all work together, you have a good time, you workshop stuff for a long time, same people come back movie after movie. And Lucas, on the other hand, he goes off and starts Lucasfilm, because he's really into the technology and almost like a small business owner into getting your kind of spreadsheet right. You know, his dad owned a stationery shop and he's kind of like, look, if I make this film and I own it and then I fund that into that film, and if I own the special effects house and the sound mixing house, you know, that's the way I get the kind of financial independence, which he did through Star Wars, obviously. Whereas Coppola kind of thought, you know, if I get groovy people together and take big swings and make exciting films, people will get excited, and we'll make enough money to be free. And there were kind of two different visions of doing that.
And the book goes through how Coppola, it's a boom and bust, right? He makes a lot of money. He makes it a project. He loses it. And that's been his career throughout, right? Off and on, off and on.
Yeah. And for better or for worse, you know, stuff like this new movie, Megalopolis, you know, I think it's a terrible movie, but I love it as a movie because most older filmmakers his age, they stay on the winery. Yeah. they drink the wine, they have a good time, to go do talks. And he's going, nah, I'm going to blow it all on some weird thing I've been wanting to make for 40 years. And he does that all the way through. You know, he makes Godfather money, and then he almost blows it. And then he makes Godfather 2 money, and he goes, oh, I'll make Apocalypse Now, almost blows it. And then he makes Apocalypse money, and then he blows it on another studio and One from the Heart and goes bankrupt. And just can't help himself, you know, and every time he starts it, you know, Apocalypse Now in his mind started almost like a Raiders of the Lost Ark. He was like, oh, people love jungle action movies. I'm going to give them a nice, simple jungle action movie. But he was a very interesting artist in the sense that he can't help himself. Yeah. The second he gets into it, he makes it more complicated. Whereas Lucas was much steadier, you know. I'll do the Star Wars film, and I'll do a sequel to that, and then a sequel to that. And as it goes, I will build this place called Skywalker Ranch, which is a home for me, which I can rent out to people. Much, much more methodical about building that base.
Yeah. Hey, just to back up for just 1 second, why was the system broken? Why was the studio system broken that allowed Coppola and Lucas to kind of go off on their own?
Well, so in the old days, the idea of the system was each studio kind of had a personality. You know, you went to Warner Brothers for gangsters films, you went to MGM for musicals, that kind of thing. Bit of an oversimplification, but it worked that way. And the system was reliable in the sense that the studios had film directors and actors under contract, and the crew members were kind of union guys under contract. And everything went through the centralized system of the studio, and then it went into cinemas that they controlled, and there was no real other game in town, and they made dozens and dozens and hundreds of films every year. And so if you wanted to go get entertainment, there was the radio, or you went to the movies, and you were like, ah, the new Warner Brothers, Humphrey Bogart, Jimmy Cagney gangster film is coming. And it was kind of reliable. And then in the late 40s, the Supreme Court goes, well, actually, you guys making the movies and showing the movies, that sounds a bit monopoly-y. So we're going to break that up. You can't own the cinemas anymore. And so now the people who own the cinemas are like, great, I don't have to block book all those Warner Brothers films. I can get some other stuff in. You know, I hear, and pretty soon they go, oh, there's this guy called Fellini, and this guy called Truffaut, and this guy called Bergman. Maybe we'll get their stuff in. And so they start doing that. And around the same period, Olivia de Havilland, Gone with the Wind actress, great actress, she kind of goes to Jack Warner, hey, I don't want to make the movies you tell me I have to make. I want to be allowed to say no, and if my contract expires while I say no, then tough luck to you. And the courts tell her she's allowed to do that. So basically then directors and actors become freelance contractors who can choose their own projects. And so the studios had been thriving on this kind of reliable system that now they're competing with other films that can get into cinemas, and they're having to find material that actors and directors want to make. But then actors and directors go, oh, I could originate my own material. I don't need you anymore. And then television comes in and people go, well, convince me to leave my house. I can watch TV. And so that's the kind of world they come into, where these old guys who are in their 70s at the studios are like, well, what do we do now? We don't control the thing anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the picture you get is of Coppola, a man of enormous talent and enormous appetites, with this boom and bust we've been talking about. But Lucas, as you were saying, comes off almost like a businessman for whom film and special effects was just a product. I mean, his biggest impact, you know, may have been in the special effects realm in terms of what's happened to entertainment. Is that fair?
I think so, yeah. Like the stuff that, well, on the one hand, there's the literal version of that, you know, ILM, you know, THX sound systems, all of that stuff that he's invented. But then there's also this idea that sort of before Star Wars, you kind of made films and convinced people to see them. And there was this idea that you had to make a good film for people to come and see it. And then there were many studio executives who saw the success of Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, who thought, you know what, actually, they don't need to be good. We just need to get people excited to see them. And, you know, instead of being a word of mouth kind of system, we're now going to be into a hype kind of system. Yeah. And the way we get people reliably excited to see stuff is they need to know kind of what it is. So that means sequels, that means franchises, and that means special effects. people loved Star Wars because it was a big show of the kind they'd never seen before, doing computer effects of the kind they'd never seen before. And so film executives kind of went, you know, all the other stuff that Lucas likes, like the good movies and the filmmaking and the narrative and all that, we don't need to worry about that much. When the audiences realize that's not in the movie, they'll have paid already because we're going to front load everything onto the opening weekend. And so, you know, stuff now where, you know, you're watching the 29th Marvel film you've seen and, you know, Ted Sarandos, the guy who runs Netflix, you know, a few years ago, you know, we need a Star Wars. That's kind of the thing you get in studios now, where we need our Star Wars. And then there was also this dimension that with the first Star Wars film, when Lucas made it, there was something called garbage clauses in contracts, which was kind of like, you know, who controls the t-shirts and the toys and whatever, because no one's buying a toy from The Sound of Music, so no one cared. And then Lucas goes, no, I'd like to keep those. And the studios go, okay, that stuff's garbage. You can have it if it makes you happy. And then the system realized, oh, actually, this guy is getting rich off the toys and the lunchboxes and the socks and the t-shirts and the rides. So we need to make more films that allow us to sell socks and t-shirts and lunchboxes and toys. And so it's kind of the monkey's paw thing of the thing that worked for him. The system kind of sucked out the artistry.
Yeah,
and took everything else, and you kind of pioneer this world that's the opposite of what you would wish for yourself.
Yeah. So of the three men, you know, we jump into Spielberg. He seemed to be the most productive. Now, how challenging was the Jaws shoot, and how did it set him up for the rest of his career?
Well, he had so Spielberg was friendly with those two guys early on, and he felt like he was the guy who was catching up. He didn't get into film school. He didn't have the same kind of reputations. And his thing was, I want to be successful and have creative and financial freedom. Same thing you guys want to have. But I want to do it through the system. I want to be able to use the system instead of destroy the system. And so he settles as a young man for this TV contract. Very old-fashioned, 7 years doing TV for Universal. And kind of gets stuck doing that. And then eventually Jaws is his second film. And the thing you kind of forget now, because it's kind of a foregone conclusion, is no one had done anything like out on the real sea. His whole thing was like, no, I don't want to do it in a tank. I don't want to do it where it looks fake. I don't want it to look like a B movie. We're going to go out on the ocean and do it on the ocean. And these guys, they were very, very intelligent, experienced men. They were also idiots. They kind of start with this thing of like, yeah, we'll go to the Atlantic Ocean. We can train some sharks, right? We train dogs and horses. We'll train some sharks to do stuff. And so they get out on the sea. And there's great accounts of people in Martha's Vineyards going, what are these guys doing? But the sun's changing. The wind is changing. They're going to get stuck out there. The tide is moving. Have these guys ever seen water? And obviously, they're all like California dorks. So the only water they've seen is like, you know, guys surfing or like doing push-ups in Venice Beach. And so the shoot kind of, they can't train the shark. So then they're like, oh, we'll build a shark. How hard can it be to build a shark? It's a machine. So they build a shark. They put it in salt water. The whole thing falls apart.
Yeah.
And so it's a whole process. And then, you know, they're like, oh, we'll be done in a couple of months. It's a normal film shoot. It'll be easy. And because of all these delays, they're not done in a couple of months. And suddenly it's 4th of July and holidaymakers are moving in and locals are going, well, you know, your crew's bedrooms are four times the price now. And Spielberg's whole plan of I'm filming on the ocean so you don't see a backdrop or any boats. Well, you've got girls on their yachts and guys jet skiing in the background now. So you got to go further out to film so there's no one around. And so the thing kind of drags on and on and on. And famously, the shark doesn't work. So he has, you know, all these big things he storyboarded of like shots of sharks doing cool tricks and you're tracking him through the water. He can't get. So eventually after all this, and it's, you know, they went like 100-something days over budget, you know, like most of a year. Oh, over schedule, sorry. And he nearly gets fired a bunch of times. But he comes up with this strength of like, okay, I've got to do it myself within the system. I've got to have my arrogance to do it myself. But also there's a way where I can suggest things. So obviously in Jaws, you don't see the shark all that much. You know, it's the suggestion of the shark that's creepy. And he kind of meets this John Williams composer guy and finds ways that the music can work. And so it's kind of like an origin story of all this stuff coming together where he grows into himself as a filmmaker to go, okay, I can use the tools of the system, but I'm also good enough to kind of ride that wave. You know, like the stuff like Coppola would talk about making films and getting overwhelmed by the time he got to the edit. And then people would talk about Spielberg being able to remember one shot they took on a Tuesday in February and how it would match another shot they took on a Friday in September, and knowing exactly where they were and what they looked like and how they cut together and all that kind of thing. And then also understanding, you know, Jaws was the first film where people went, you know what, let's put in hundreds of cinemas day one and let's make people feel you have to come see this on Friday. Don't wait for the reviews. Don't wait for word of mouth. You're going to want to see it before everybody else. And so he understands that system too early on.
Paul, we could go on for another half an hour, but I'm afraid we're out of time. I would really like to talk more about Spielberg. Listen, the book is The Last Kings of Hollywood, Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg, and the Battle for the Soul of American Cinema. It's a great read. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. Have a good day.
We'll be right back after this.